Hello and welcome to You Really Shouldn't Have, with me, James Warwick. Each week, I sit down with a guest to discuss their career, as well as swapping stories on the worst gift they've ever been given. Joining me this week is Kenny Lee Lewis, bass guitarist for the Steve Miller Band. Enjoy. Well, Kenny, thanks so much for joining me on the show. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, James. I'm really happy that I was able to find some time here to be able to talk to you across the big pond.
Absolutely, across the big pond, and it's great to have you here. If we go right back to the beginning, Kenny, was music always an early influence on your life growing up?
Yes, my dad was a big swing nut and, you know, was really into Count Basie and, you know, Duke Ellington, Woody Herman. He used to play these records all the time in the house. And he also had a drum set set up when I was a little kid, so I banged around on that. He also had a guitar, showed me my first chords. And then my brother and sister became folkies in the early 60s and started doing all the Peter, Paul, and Mary and Brothers Four, Kingston Trio tunes and, you know, Mamas the Papas. And so I started learning that on ukulele pretty early because I was younger than them. They were 6 and 7 years older, and I was missing out on all the action at the family functions. So I begged off on a ukulele from my aunt and started teaching myself how to play uke. And so that's how it all kind of started.
And when did you then switch from the uke to the guitar? When did that first begin?
When my hand got big enough, probably around, you know, probably around fifth, sixth grade, you started being able to get my hand around it pretty well.
So I know you started out before Steve Miller Band, you started out as a studio musician. So how did that opportunity first present itself to you?
Well, I moved to LA from a college band situation up in Sacramento, which is the capital of California. And I wanted to become a studio musician. I had a friend who was the drummer in all of my high school bands who had brothers that were all in the business down in LA. And they sort of, kind of gave me advice and stuff. I wouldn't say that they hired me on gigs right away, but they did help me get kind of my foot in the door. And I moved down there after my first semester in college, and that was 1973. And I wanted to be a studio musician. Of course, I hit town and went to CSUN, Cal State University Northridge, which had an incredible music program. And found out that I was just a small fish in a really big pond, where it was just the reverse up in Sacramento. And I got a little depressed, got a job at a music store, eventually went on the road with a steakhouse California rock band, if you will. And we wore outfits, went around the country and played all the cover tunes and stuff. And that was kind of interesting. But took me a while to get my foot in the door. Really what started me was I met my wife, Diane Steinberg, who at that time had already had a record out on Atlantic Records. And she was going for a second record on ABC Dunhill. And she was doing a trio around town in Los Angeles, and she needed a bass player. And I'd already met her through a friend, and she got kind of stuck for a bass player. And because I read notation, I read bass, she gave me an audition. I got the gig. We became friends. We started writing songs. And then eventually we did her record at Producer's Workshop at the same time that Fleetwood Mac was doing Rumors in the same studio. So that was 1976, 77. And so she eventually got the role of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds in the Sgt. Pepper movie with Peter Frampton and the Bee Gees. Wow. And so that was her big claim to fame in addition to a couple other records. But on her record is when we had producers that hired, you know, some of the guys were in Toto. We had Jeff Porcaro and David Page. We had Jay Graydon on guitar. I don't think Steve Lukather had gotten on this yet, but we, you know, did her record, and I met all these studio musicians, and they really liked my bass playing, and then they started recommending me, and that's how I got started in the studio business.
So then, moving on from that, how did you first get involved with Steve Miller Band?
Well, in the middle of doing a lot of session work from 76 through about 80, I ended up getting in a band called Gerard McMahon and Kid Lightning. And the drummer for that band was a guy named Gary Malibur. And Gary Malibur had played on a lot of big hit records, including going all the way back to Moondance by Van Morrison. And eventually he did most of the Steve Miller hits and Eddie Money hits and so he even played on Peter Frampton's records and stuff. But he was the drummer for this band, and it was a situation where the singer, this guy Gerard, was you know, letting the band write material for the project. And so Gary and I and Gerard and this guy named John Massaro started becoming songwriter partners. Eventually we had two records come out with that group and nothing happened. And so Gary and John and I decided to try to go for our own record deal. And we started writing material. We had eight songs in the can that we'd mixed and we're getting ready to go for a deal. And that's when Steve Miller calls out of the blue and says, "Hey, you got any material out of a record by Christmas?" And I'm dry. And Gary came in, we had a band meeting real quick, and he said, "Well, let's send him our demos if he maybe wants to do a song." And he was so impressed by our stuff, he took all eight of them and kind of wiped us out. We didn't have any more songs. And then he not only didn't like the songs, but he liked the masters. He had recorded them in Gary's garage on a TAC 80-8 half-inch machine, 15 IPS with DBX, something like that. And we transferred that to 24-track 2-inch, took it to Capitol, and that's when Steve started working on the Abracadabra album. And that's when he asked me to start coming down and helping him produce the record with he and Gary, because he really liked my guitar playing, he liked my bass playing, he liked my songs. And I met him as a peer. I met him as somebody who needed material from me. And so I wasn't even asked to join the band until after we'd actually finished the record. And one day he just called me and said, "Hey, you know, why don't you come to the album photo session tomorrow? Because you played on everything. You helped me produce this. You helped me kind of develop this record. Why don't you just help me kind of promote it?" So I didn't really have to audition. I just had to make the decision if I wanted to give up my studio career. And in hindsight, it was a pretty good decision.
It must have been quite a risk, though, at the time, looking back at it. Was it quite risky to hand over all of the songs that you'd written to Steve?
Not really, because I could always write more songs. But it was a time when we wanted to go for a record deal. We were motivated. We felt pretty cocky. I had already done three records, and none of them had taken off. So I kind of knew how to do it. I knew how to write a hit. And I just was ready to do it for myself. And I was singing lead, you know, on my first record deal, which was something that was new to me. But I started feeling pretty confident about that. So, yeah, to give up all the songs, it was kind of tough. But it wasn't bad because, you know, by having that amount of tunes on a record that sold 5 million copies, we got a lot of mechanical royalties from just being attached to the single, which was Abracadabra, which unfortunately I did not write.
You mentioned the album, the Abracadabra. What was the experience like of putting that album together? And of course, the experience of getting your first number one single with the title track.
Well, the title track in particular was the last thing we were working on. All the other songs that were finished, all Steve had to do is kind of take what John had sang, our co-writer, who was a very good vocalist, and just copy his lead vocals and just put a couple guitar parts of his own on and whatnot. So the record went pretty quick as far as that was. But Abracadabra was not a song that we wrote. It was a song he had left over from an album prior that was called Macho Children, and it was really bad, the lyrics that were. But the track was really good, and had that really nice little pogo pump, kind of almost like a ska feel, and it was in minor, which was kind of cool. And it sounded kind of European, you know, but we weren't necessarily trying to go over a European market. But he finally wrote some new lyrics for it after us telling him not to throw the song off the record. And he came in with this doggone Abracadabra, "Wanna Reach Out and Grab Me." We went, yeah. So the last thing that he was working on was the guitar solo. And at that time, his girlfriend, Kim, walked in the control room one day when it was in the studio part. He had no talk back. He was just doing guitar overdubs. And she walked into the control room and he did a cat call on his guitar. He went like, on his neck. And then he took this wang bar that I had taught him how to keep in tune on a Stratocaster. And he went like, wah. It was just kind of like trying to express himself to her that he thought she looked hot, you know. And we all looked at each other after two or three days of, you know, laboring over this big, long harmonic minor, you know, kind of Carlos Santana kind of solo that he was trying to do. And we all jumped on the talkback. We said, "Do that again." And he did. We said, "You know what? You need to do that kind of stuff for the solo. We'll sample it on the half track. We'll put it here. We'll put it there. We'll kind of space it into the stereo audio spectrum. We'll get Byron to come in. He'll do the S&M whip, you know, and all that stuff." So after we got that going, that's how we were able to, you know, make a hit record. Oh my God.
Kenny, what's the worst gift you've ever been given?
Worst gift? Steve is very competitive with the guitar chair in the band. Of course, Bob Skaggs was the first guy. And then a lot of other people like Les Dudek and Greg Douglas and other people that came after that take a lot of heat from Steve because Steve plays guitar, you know, and that's what he knows. And so he's a little bit competitive. And if he gives you solos, you know, he's kind of looking at you. And so he's always a little competitive. So that being said, I was his guitar player for 28 years from, you know, from 82 when we started the Abracadabra Tour on and off all the way through about 2010 when I switched over to bass when our bass player broke his ankle and he couldn't, you know, come out and do the tour that we were in the middle of. So I switched back over to bass and everybody loved my bass playing. So they kept me on bass and that's been great, you know, cause he doesn't really know a whole lot about bass and he just, you know, leaves me alone. But when I was the guitar player, he was always, you know, teasing me and, you know, telling me this, telling me that. And I sort of have an inherent genetic. I sort of have a genetic double chin from my mother. And even when I was pretty skinny, I still had a little poof there, you know, because I don't have like a really big jawline. That's why I wear a beard. But anyway, he took it upon himself to give me a birthday joke gift once, which, and I just sent pictures to Eileen, the lady that introduced me to you. And what it was a double chin exercise barbell set. And you would put a mouthpiece in your mouth and bite down on it, kind of like a, you know, like a sports mouthpiece. And then you had this thing that came out with just like a little stick with a little holder on it. And you put little baby barbells on it. And you'd sit and you'd exercise your jaw to try to get rid of this double chin, which of course is ridiculous. It's never going to go away. But he thought that was funny. It was sort of like an off-color joke. So it was a little bit of an insult, but it was also sort of comedy at the same time. And that's, you know, that's pretty typical Steve Miller humor. Because he is, after all, the Joker.
Absolutely. I have my own Abracadabra story that I thought you might like to hear. I reminded myself of it while I was researching the questions for this interview. So about 10 years ago, I used to work on a small local radio station here in the UK. I was about 16, 17 at the time, and I used to present the Saturday morning breakfast show. And all of the songs were on a computer system, as is now, you know, no more CDs or records as it was back in the day. But there was an emergency CD player that was linked to the desk. And if it had like 10, if I sensed like 10 seconds of what they call dead air, the CD player would automatically kick in. Well, the first track on the emergency CD was Abracadabra. So the running joke was that if you ever tuned in and heard Abracadabra, it was likely that something had gone wrong.
That's funny. Yeah, I remember when it was transferred to cassette, it was a big deal because, you know, we were still making vinyl in 1981, 82 when we made the record. And then, of course, compact disc came out 86, 87, and the record got transferred to CD. And it was like, ooh, you know, it's like a big deal, you know. It was pretty funny. But fortunately, his greatest hits also got transferred to CD, and it started sounding like hotcakes. And that's where our live business exploded from about 88 till present. It went digital, and of course now it's streams and whatnot.
Sure.
But it built a whole new audience, younger college kids and stuff, because they were kind of all into that technology thing, and they all liked music, but they just didn't necessarily want to mess with vinyl at that time. Of course, now people want to because it's kitschy, but you know, it was nice to have everything digitized, so we got like another breath of life breathed into our catalog.
You mentioned touring there, which leads me on nicely to my next question, which was around sort of the memories of your time out on the road. But also, I know you guys are still touring pretty regularly, but how has the coronavirus impacted that for you this year, obviously, with everything shutting down?
Pretty much turned off the faucet. You know, we don't have any water coming in the faucet anymore. And, you know, we're just all sort of sitting around waiting for something to happen. I myself am doing streams. I've been doing streams from my house. And also I just did a really nice big professional one out in Pennsylvania last week.
Oh, nice.
And for the state house, believe it or not, because I know the speaker of the house, and they had a fundraiser pack, and they originally had booked it as a live audience gig, but then they decided rather than canceling it, they said, well, let's just fly out here like we were going to do, because they had a beautiful sound stage out in Lititz where they were, and they said, you know, let's just do a stream, and we'll just do a private key for all of our donors, and it'll be kind of like a party. And so we did that, but that was the only good paying gig I've had probably since March.
Wow.
All the other stuff has just been streaming for donations and then little things here and there. I went up to Montana. I was able to work up there for the 4th of July because in Montana at the time, they were not even believing that the coronavirus was even real. Nobody was wearing masks, you know, and everybody was slapping me on the back, wanting to do bro hugs, you know. But of course, now they have a huge spike there. For their lack of being, you know, paying attention to the guidelines. But that, there you go. You know, I mean, that's just the way our country is. We have a lot of stubborn people in the flyover states that don't want to see reality the way it really is.
I wanted to touch a little bit on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, because I know you got the opportunity to play there with Steve, but I know there was some controversy around the whole event, so I didn't want to pry into it too much, and you could explain it how you want to explain it.
Ask a specific question.
Well, I heard that you weren't originally going to play with him.
That is true. The producers, they don't really like it when they have to do a band that has a band logo name, even though they have to. Like we had Deep Purple, for instance, when we were being inducted. And when you say Deep Purple, there was a million people who were in Deep Purple over the years. If you bring them all and you put them all up on stage, they'll be up there for an hour and a half saying hi to their mom. You know, so with Steve, because it was the name of a person, they kind of went, well, you know, rather than having the whole bunch of guys, because there was still a lot of, there's still a lot of people that are still alive that have been in the band in the past, especially guys that had played on the hits, you know, because I had not ever played on any of the hits.
Sure.
I had only played on Abracadabra, the album, and wrote songs. But the second single on Abracadabra, which was one of my songs, never was a hit. You know, so I never had a hit. I never played on a hit with him. So there were other people who were even more qualified than me to be there, frankly. But they were just wanting to induct him and have him, you know, perform with Paul Schaefer and the guys, you know. And that's when he refused. He says, no. If I'm going to go up there and play, I want to go with my band with all my harmony stacks and my arrangements. And, you know, I want my band. And they went, well, okay, well, then they'll have to sit in the green room and eat bandwiches. And, you know, it was just like it just went, kept going downhill. So then our manager got involved and he got involved. And, you know, they said, no. If they're going to come and play and perform, they're going to sit on the floor with everybody else. Come on, you know. Well, it's $10,000 a seat even in the back. So who cares? Give them free seats. And if they want to bring their wives, they can bring their wives. You know, so it became that kind of stuff because they turned the thing into like a money-making thing. It's like the Super Bowl. You know, and the guys that sit on the board are a bunch of non-musicians that basically just use our art to be a platform for them to make money off of, you know, which is, you know, pretty typical for the music industry, you know, especially for people who can't play an instrument. But anyway, I digress. So then he wanted to have a really high profile, and I might add, English superstar, induct him. And they said, no, you don't tell us who's going to induct you. We tell you who's going to induct you. And he was like, well, who's that? He goes, well, you know, it's going to be the Black Keys. He goes, I don't know who they are. What do they do? It was pretty funny. And so, you know, it just went downhill from there. And then, you know, what happened was is that we found out what we wanted. We were able to come. We were able to play. We were able to sit on the floor with everybody. We brought our wives. We didn't have to eat bandwiches. We got to eat off the buffet. it was funny. But they still decided to only induct him. They didn't induct the band name because they, again, didn't want everybody and the monkey's uncle up on stage. So that's the only difference. I did get an award, though, and through the back door. I don't know where it came from. If I think if some friend of mine had a maid, but we did get awards, all the people in the band.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice.
Right. And Steve was the one that was, you know, the speech giver, and they got him on and off quick. Because Cheap, same thing. They had a bunch of people up there. Not a lot, because, you know, Cheap Trick's pretty much been original. That was kind of the situation that had occurred. And so I probably would not have gone very public, except for when Steve came out of the venue with his little trophy and, you know, they kind of went into like a little press, you know, gauntlet. Somebody said, oh, Steve Miller, how was your experience with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? And he kind of went, you really want to know? And he told him.
Kenny, wrapping up, if you had to go right back to the beginning of your career and get yourself a gift to help to get where you are now, what gift would you give yourself?
A gift. Oh, well, when I first went to get my first electric guitar, I saved up money. My dad owed me some money. And I was just going from the sixth to the seventh grade. And I went down to a pawn shop in Sacramento, and they had a real beautiful cherry red Gibson. I can't remember whether it was an ES-335 or if it was an ES-330. Either way, it was gorgeous. And it was sitting in the window, and it was $135. I only had about $100 to spend, and I had to get an amp because I couldn't just buy an electric guitar without an amplifier.
Sure.
So I kept asking my dad if he could just give me a little more so I could get an amp to go with that Gibson. And he said, no, I just don't have it. So as it were, the guy ends up selling me some Japanese impersonation thing looking thing of the Gibson 335 and an amp for $115 plus tax or whatever. So I think we got out of there for about $130. And I could have gotten the Gibson, and I probably would have been a better player quicker. And wouldn't have taken me so long, because it took me a while. I mean, because this guitar I had was kind of janky, and it took me about a year and a half of messing around with that and borrowing other people's guitars that I finally realized, God, if I got a good guitar, I could really get good fast. So I think I would have gone back in time, and I would have gotten that Gibson and figured out a way to get an amp. So that would have been the gift I would have bought myself at that time.
Fantastic. And Kenny, finally, where can people find out more about you and what you do?
Well, you can go to KennyLeeLewis.com, and that's my website. There's a lot of information and links on there. Also on Facebook, Kenny Lee Lewis Personal, Kenny Lee Lewis Artist. I have a couple bands. One is called Barfly, A-R-F-L-Y-Z as in zebra, music.com. That's a website, and also a Facebook page, and also The Friend, F-R-E-N-Z as in zebra, music. .com, another website, and also on Facebook. And you can kind of see the different things I do. There's music featured on there. I'm also a novelist. I have a sci-fi fantasy novel on Amazon, which is called Skeleton Dolls, Children of the Tower. And it's the story of about female twins who use twin speak language, and they take it in their adulthood. We know it's the original language of God before the Tower of Babel was destroyed, and it has power, and they can raise the dead and heal people and get into all kinds of trouble. And it's a really great book, and people are having fun with that. I had a sequel shopping now. Also, go to theblurband.com and see videos and presence there. And then my YouTube channel, Kenny Lee Lewis YouTube channel, I'm just getting ready to develop. I'm getting ready to do a whole series of master classes, philosophy performances, and, even a cooking show, because I'm kind of a cook too.
Oh, nice.
So all that is going on.
Fantastic. Well, Kenny, thanks so much for stopping by and coming on the show. I really appreciate having you on.
You're welcome, James, and cheers, man.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of You Really Shouldn't Have. Be sure to subscribe to us on your chosen podcast service to make sure you never miss another episode. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram @BadGiftsPod, as well as online at badgiftspod.com.